Yeah, good morning. Welcome to the lectures on quantum key distribution. Talking about quantum key distribution is a challenge because everyone knows something about quantum key distribution. So the problem is how to talk about this, to introduce the subject without boring you to death, and still, at the end of the day, really in itself being able to tell maybe something new to you. Right? So basically, I have to find a way how to catch all of you with all your pre-knowledge, draw you in there, and then basically from there on to advance. So let's see how that one is going. The first thing is the motivation. And of course, motivation is just something about cryptography. How do we actually nowadays actually use cryptography? And basically, one of the most important algorithms to be used today is a kind of Diffie-Hellman algorithm, which is just a way how to distribute a key to two people, right? And to do that one in a kind of symmetric fashion, right? And basically, what we use today for cryptographic methods is always to use a problem where we basically know that basically we can just do a calculation which goes in one way easily, and to invert a calculation is just difficult to do. Right? So one of the possibilities to do that is just basically to use a problem about exponentiation, and that is the exponentiation modulo p, where p is some prime. Right? So it's very easy to take the power of a number, right? And as well doing that modulo some prime number. But if I give you the number and ask you for the logarithm of that, you have a problem. Of course, here the important thing is that we talk about something modulo p, right? Because otherwise logarithms, we know usually how to take them. It's really the important thing is about the modulo of a number, right? And so basically now, how do two persons actually use this kind of algorithm? And the thing is just basically that there are two people who want to establish a key which they can use for secret communication, right? And basically how does that actually work, right? Well, how that works is just that one party just picks a random number, yeah? That can be easily done, yeah? And just picks as well a number G. Or better to say, both parties agree on the number G, and then basically you just take the exponentiation, right, modulo p, and the other party as well picks a random number, does the exponentiation, modulo p with that number, right, so that is all easy to do, and what they just do, they just send these numbers to the other side, right. Well, once the one party, Alice sends to Amazon over here, the number, then basically the receiver over here can just do another exponentiation basically of that received number with the number that he just came up with, right? And get just the kind of g to the power of x times y. Right? Okay, that's one part. So the other part basically now says, okay, now that guy over here sends his exponentiation number over here to the other side, and again, this party over here can locally calculate as well this exponent, right? So both parties are now able to have z to the power x times y, right? The thing is, once they know that, right, they can use this number as a secret key in communication, and we come to that again. And basically for us the important thing is, of course, what happens basically for someone who listens to all that conversation, right? The thing is basically what someone hears when he listens to that channel over here, he hears is g to the x, g to the y, right? And now the question, can he conclude what is g to the x times y, right? And here is just our experience, no. Right? And the experience says it's basically hard to get from these numbers the x again, because once I would know x, then I could just listen to that one and do this exponentiation, right? Or the same, of course, with the y. So to find the exponent is a problem which we, in our experience, is hard to do, right? It is something which, of course, in principle you can do, just a question about the computational power that is available to you, right? How long does it take to find these numbers, right? And so basically, as long as these random numbers x and y are long enough, then we basically can say, look, until someone finds out what these numbers are, yeah, we are all dead anyway, so we don't care about that one. So that is basically the kind of flavor of what we do today in cryptography, and that is just about basically everything that we're doing whenever we talk about internet security, for example. If you do public key cryptography, all of that are basically based on these type of problems. Right? So now, as we talk about that, we have to be, of course, very careful, right? What we're really seeing over here. And that is just basically we go about computational assumptions. Right? We just say, well, we think it is hard to invert the exponentiation modulo p. Or for public key cryptography, we think it is hard to factor large numbers. Right? But the problem is, of course, first, hard means not impossible. Right? Hard just means it takes a long time and it takes computational effort. But of course, time, basically the question how long does it take to calculate these discrete logarithms over here, is just a question about how fast the computers are. Well, we have a good kind of a good feeling what the computational power of our computers are. We have Moore's law, right, which tells us basically in which can how many months basically the computational power typically doubles, right? And so basically we have a feeling, we have an idea how computational power actually increases, right? And so then we can actually, based on that one, we can just taking in effect basically the known algorithms that you can try to find here, the logarithms over here, we can just say, okay, how much time will it take now, how much time will it take in a few years to crack these numbers? But the problem is, of course, that computational power follows not only Moore's law, but we have one of the example a few years back, or decades back now, that suddenly with the internet, we had the Linux clusters available. Right? And so basically now you have only not only one computer on your desk that can work on those things, but you can just use basically parallelize the whole problem. And to get much more computational power available, right? So that is something which does not follow Moore's law. Each individual computer follows Moore's law. But the computational power available to individual users suddenly increased dramatically. Right? That is as well why some of these RSA challenges for public key cryptography, where initially claims have been made, oh, that's safe basically for I don't know how many million years, that all of those are basically broken. Right? We have as well more things, yeah? And that is basically these predictions, how long does it take to crack today's schemes, is of course based as well on algorithms that we know today. Yeah? But what we really would love to do, of course, if we classically we could say something about the complexity, computational complexity of the problems that we talk about. Right? The thing is basically nothing is really known about that. All our statements about classical cryptography is hard to break for these schemes over here, like the Diffie-Hellman scheme, is just based on the best algorithm that we can think about, or the one that is the best one that is publicly known. We don't know whether other people maybe have a better idea what to try. Maybe they know some shortcuts that are not published, right? So there's always some worry about that one. Or as well, I mean, basically, maybe tomorrow someone finds an algorithm and actually allows us to break those schemes much easier. The important thing as well, of course, and that is probably as well why we are here, is the question as well, we have quantum computers, and now once we know if we have a quantum computer, then we actually know that we can efficiently solve and break those schemes. Right? So, of course, we have not built a quantum computer yet, but that is, of course, again, a very serious threat about what is going on. Right. And so quantum computers can break, basically can factorize large numbers, as a Shor algorithm, but they as well can the same thing actually rephrase to break the Diffie-Hellman scheme, but to break basically the discrete log problem, and as well you can use a quantum computer for that one. Right. Now, the important thing therefore is something which classical cryptographers certainly are aiming for, and that is just the question, can we actually find schemes that can actually prove security in a well-defined manner, right? Rather than to say, well, I don't know a way how to break it, or it takes too long to break it, or whatsoever, are there schemes that actually can prove they cannot be broken in communication? And of course, there's one way of doing that one, and that is the so-called one-time pad. Right? So the idea of that one is just that you just take your message over here, and that both parties, Alice and Bob, share a secret key. A secret key is just a random sequence of zeros and ones, right? Shared by those people and by no one else. And what you then can do just is the XOR between the message, just bit by bit, into the cryptogram over here. Right? This one now can be sent over a public channel. Once you and someone receives it over here, then he can just XOR that cryptogram with that key again and recover the message. Right? So when we go through that one, the first thing is, of course, we see first, yes, the receiver can receive the message, which is, of course, the first thing if you want to secure communication. At least you can do communication, right? That's the only thing we have been proving so far, right? I can basically, if Alice and Bob share a key, right, then they can transmit a message over here. Now, the important thing is, of course, again, we have to look at this point and see basically what does an eavesdropper actually gain from seeing this cryptogram over here, right? So if you listen to that one, can you make actually conclusion about what the message is, right? And for that one, let's say the eavesdropper sees over here that sequence, right? And now the eavesdropper can say, well, look, I saw that message, and basically he can ask the question, well, could the message have been indeed finished, see you tomorrow? And the answer is always, yes, that could have been the message, provided the key was, and then here comes something over here, right? On the other hand, you can ask, well, maybe did it say decoyed off, I'm off to Hawaii? And the answer is, yes, that could have been the message if the key was a different one, maybe this one over here. Right? So now for you as an eavesdropper, so what do you think the message was? Right? The thing is, as long as this key over here was chosen at random, yeah, then both possibilities are equally likely from your point of view as the point of view of an eavesdropper. And that means you have no clue what the message really was. Right? All messages basically are equally likely, and that is so because all keys are equally likely. Right? And you don't know anything about the key as an eavesdropper over here. So the important thing is the keys have to be chosen at random. Right? So there should be no structure or anything like that in the key. Right? The thing is as well, they have to be the same length as the message, and the important thing as well, they can be used only once. Right? There's actually something easy to see the moment if you use a key twice, you actually get a problem, right? Because information leaks to an eavesdropper, right? And that is something that we can just see. Which spot to use? Just say we use one message, right, which is 010, right, and we use a kind of key, which is 110, right. Then it says that our first cryptogram over here is just 100. Right. Now let's assume we are lazy, right, and we just try to reuse that key. So we have a second message. And that is just, say, this one over here. Right? And we take again the key, and we get a second cryptogram, 001. Right? So an eavesdropper over here sees this one, Eve sees this one, and Eve sees that one. Right? Now, the important thing is, in that case, Eve can learn something about your messages. It's not like Eve can completely break the message, find both of them. But the important thing is that once you calculate, Eve can calculate this thing, C1 plus C2. Right? The thing is, of course, since C1 was just the message 1 plus K, and that's the second one where mass is 2 plus k, then actually the key falls out of that and you get m1 plus m2 over here. Yeah. So that is in our case over here, if you go from here, so now eavesdropper knows m1 plus m2 is equal to 1, 0, 1. That is already some information. Right? But from all possibilities that we have, but for each kind of bit values on the two messages, you can always already rule out two of the combinations. Here you know that that those have to be different, these message bits. Right? That's a lot of information that eavesdropper actually gets from that. Right? So key can be used only once. Otherwise, indeed, information about the content of your messages actually leaks out. Right? So what do we need? Yeah. The good part is once our key satisfies all that game, right, then we have provable security, right, because I can prove that from a point of view from an eavesdropper, all messages are equally likely once he looks at this cryptogram. So basically, if either you look at that part over here or not, you don't learn anything from that. That means you are not any wiser by looking at that thing over here than you were before. Because, I mean, pure guessing between the two things, you can, of course, do. Always with or without cryptography, right? So always the question is whether you can learn something from the communication more than your initial guessing. The answer here would be no. Right? You see, of course, doing that, that is a provable way of doing secure communication, but the thing is, of course, we see that we have basically just shifted our problem. Right? The one thing is, how can I communicate between two parties so that no one else can listen to it? But what we now shift is the problem to how to distribute key. Because this thing over here, key can be used only once, means that key is something which is being used up. Right? As I communicate, I use up key. Right? And so the question is basically now, how can I produce key to two parties? Before that, I showed you the Diffie-Hellman algorithm, but that's the classical cryptography solution to this game. Right? The problem is really, there I said, this one is something which is not provably secure. We already know that a sufficient amount of computational power can actually break this classical Diffie-Hellman scheme. Right? So we look for something different over here. And basically what we are looking over here is not the Diffie-Hellman because it uses computational assumption, but what we can use over here is just using quantum mechanics, using quantum key distribution. Right? So that is basically the option that we now try to look over here. And the point is here that we want to find a key distribution scheme where we can prove security once again, right? And not have to rely on any kind of assumptions, yeah? Okay, so let's go and just look at the principles of quantum key distribution and at the basic protocols, right? The first important thing is basically is to say something about what our assumptions, what is the picture when we start to do quantum key distribution. Well, the picture is basically that we have two parties over here, Alice and Bob, sitting over here, and key distribution means at the end of the day, each party should get out some output over here, which we call a key, one here, one there, and they should be the same, right? And no one else should know anything about this sequences over here. Because what we assume is that Alice and Bob, they sit in a sheltered environment. There they can do whatever they want, and eavesdropper does not know what they're doing in their environment. But however, these environments are not directly connected, but they just have to be connected by some channels which can be controlled by an eavesdropper. Right? That's basically the challenge in communication, right? That we have to use some channels, and the channel is not controlled by us, it's controlled by another person. Right? And nevertheless, we want to be safe, secure against that other person. So what we need in quantum key distribution are two things. We need a way to communicate between Alice and Bob in such a way that we know we're really talking to the other party. But this channel is always something where an eavesdropper can listen to it, but that basically means an eavesdropper cannot change what is being said on the channel. Right? So that is one thing that we have to be using, and we come back to that point over here. But the other important resource that we actually need is to have a channel, a quantum channel, that you can now really send quantum mechanical signals over there, right? Which support it, and so basically Alice and Bob can prepare signals and measure signals and go on with their life then. Right? So the important thing is, of course, what quantum mechanics does for us over here is that as we send a quantum mechanical signal along the channel, right, and an eavesdropper might try to tamper with that signal, right, which is the important thing here for this quantum channel, I'm not assuming anything like Eve cannot touch the signal. Right? On this thing over here, an eavesdropper can do whatever, right, on those channels. Right? And so basically now the important thing is that we of course know if I have non-orthogonal signals, I put them into a measurement, then basically on average those signals get disturbed, and that is what I want to symbolize over here by this blurred picture. Right? So basically whenever someone wants to try to find out something about which of the two signals I might send into, right, and that's and there's some information coming which tells us what probability which signal was put in, those signals will be on average being disturbed. Right? That's a good thing because disturbing means basically if I check basically, oh, am I still in this original state as a receiver, then basically that they're blurred means just simply that sometimes they will be not in the same state that I actually came into the channel. Right? And that is basically the notion of errors occurring over here. The important thing is basically that we can use that one over here. Right? And that is basically that we can say, well, here this channel over here is just something where Eve might or might not do a measurement. Right? That's basically the communication channel. We put something in and something comes out on this side, and now the question, did Eve interact with the signal? Right? And basically any interaction, any way of learning some sort of signal would always be a measurement. Right? And the thing is basically once we prove that this black box over here called the eavesdropper lets these two non-orthogonal signals through without disturbing them, then we actually know there is no eavesdropper, meaning that this channel over here is just the identity channel. Yeah, nothing happens on that subspace spent by the channels, by the signals. Right? So that's the important thing what we want to use from quantum mechanics. So we know there's always a back reaction of measurements onto non-orthogonal signals on average. Right? And that means the absence of disturbance, blurrance over here means that we had only the kind of trivial action of the channel. Right? And that means the eavesdropper didn't learn anything about our signals. So this is of course is the stuff that, as you know, that is basically means I cannot copy quantum information. Yeah. And all those equivalent formulations you can use, but I prefer really to use this formulation also about the back reaction of a measurement on the signal. So the now we are in position basically to talk about the Bennett-Brassard protocol of 84, right? And so that just uses only this kind of basic effect, right? And the thing basically what we see is basically this channel over here, which is in control of the eavesdropper, we have basically to test it to see is an eavesdropper present, does an eavesdropper try to learn something with our signals. So it's obvious that what we have to do is to use on this channel non-orthogonal signal states. Right? Because if they're orthogonal, there's always a measurement which has no feedback on the signal, it does not disturb the signals. Non-orthogonal is very important. So let's use over here now these kind of signal states, and by that we really refer to something like single photons in polarization. So that is basically what those symbols should denote at that moment. And I think Barry Sanders might have mentioned as well some other encoding schemes for that, but for our purpose today, that is good enough just to talk about these polarization states, right? And basically these polarization states of course have associated with them some measurements. So that basically the first two can be perfectly discriminated by that measurement over here, by 45 degree basis of measurement of polarization, and the second two as well can be perfectly discriminated by horizontal vertically. Right? And now the thing is our protocol just says, well, what we should do is just that Alice just goes about and just sends a random string of those signals. Right? The important thing is we want to do key distribution. Because once we have distributed a key, we can use a one-time pad for secure communication. This key has to be random, completely random. Right? That means no prediction about what are the zero and ones in there. Right? So that's very important, and therefore it means as well, in the quantum key distribution protocols, we can use all randomness. Yeah, because we do not want to establish a specific key. We just want to generate some random key, whatever it is. So it's no wonder that we can actually start here with a random sequence of signals. And as well, the receiver over here just basically selects for each of those signals at random one of the two measurements. Right? Again, we are just after randomness. Yeah, we want to get establish secret shared randomness between the two parties. Well, as you know, whenever you measure a single photon, you get an outcome. Right? That might be good or bad. So here it is good. Right? So that means you get always one of the two possibilities of your measurement as an outcome over here. So, and here I write that one down. Right? And so that is basically in quantum key distribution what we are really doing over here. We just prepare non-orthogonal signal sets, we do measurements, and we get measurement results. Right? And so that's basically the only part of where we really use quantum mechanics. After we have done these steps, we just have a classical transcript of what we have been doing. Yeah. So Alice knows which signal she sent, one which of the four. Bob knows which measurement actually he performed and what the outcome was. Right? And now everything is classical. It's just all on a piece of paper locally in Alice's and Bob's device, written down what they've been doing. Right? No further quantum mechanics use from now on required for us. Right? The important thing is, of course, now from all of that mess that we get over here, we have to be able to get a secret key. Right? At the moment, there are just some correlations there. Right? And the important thing is, of course, that these correlations are of different quality. Right? If I look at this signal and I send it through a perfect channel into that measurement, I get always that outcome. If I look at this measurement, this signal, it goes into that measurement, I just get a random outcome. Right? This outcome has nothing to do with what actually Alice originally said. Right? The important thing is now that I can actually start a second phase in quantum key distribution, and that is just I have my classical records about what I have been doing, and I now start just to talk about my data. And by talking about my data, I will end up with a secret key. Right? So everything we do now is just talking. Right? And so the first thing is that we do is just to separate these events over here into two sets. One set where basically in the absence of an eavesdropper, we would have deterministic action. Right? This signal gives deterministic over that outcome, that always gives this one over here. And I want to separate that one from those where I just get random outcomes from Bob, which has nothing to do with what Alice sent in. The important thing is that I can do that just by Alice and Bob picking up the phone, and they just discuss the basis of the signals that they have been using. Right? So you don't say which of the two options you're sending, you just talk about only about the basis. Right? So here Alice just says, I use a 45-degree basis. Bob says, oh, I use horizontal, vertical, and then say, oh, come, forget it. Yeah? Just discard that event. Here, Alice would say, I used horizontal, vertical. Bob says, hey, I did as well. And then say, okay, we keep that. Right? Eve, when Eve is listening to that, she still doesn't know whether it was horizontal or vertical. Right? But Alice and Bob know that in absence of the eavesdropper, they should have the same result. Right? So once this process is what you call the sifting process. Right? So once you have that one, right? So basically now you can actually go, so that was the sifting, now you can go and just call, basically translate your signals into zeros and ones. Right? So these two you might call zero, these two you call one. Right? And here you get now some binary numbers out of it. Right? In the absence of an eavesdropper, both of them should share the same binary string now. Right? But what happens if now there is an eavesdropper? We said basically if there's an eavesdropper and the eavesdropper learns anything about which of the signals might have passed through the channel at each instance, then these signals on average will be disturbed. On average being disturbed means that this signal, after going through an eavesdropper interaction before arriving at Bob's place, sometimes does not give the same signal, but it gives the other outcome. Well, that is something you can look for. Right? So basically what you can do over here, you just check some of those bits over here just by opening them up on the channel. You just check, do I indeed have perfect correlation between Alice and Bob? Right? So that is basically, this check is a check for the absence or presence of knee stopper. Well, if you find errors in the whole game, then you can just say, sorry, knee stopper on the line, forget about it, let's try again tomorrow. Or go, or maybe send someone along the line to find and shoot the eavesdropper, or whatever you want to do. Right? The important thing is, of course, an eavesdropper can always prevent you to make a secret key by interacting with your signals, introducing errors. No problem. But this protocol is designed that if you find there was no eavesdropper, then this key, then you can use the key and you can be assured that no one else knows about that. Right? So that is, again, the very important part. Right? There's always a so-called denial of service attack. There's some eavesdropper just blocks you from making a secret key. But an eavesdropper can never fool you in thinking that you have a secret key if you have not. You have a question?
Yeah. Can you eavesdropper change the data on classical channel?
No. Over here, on the classic channel, Eve cannot change something and become come to that point, which is because it's very important. Yeah, that is a very important thing. So for the moment, just basically, when Els and Bob talk, Eve cannot change that signal what is sent over the classic channel. And we, of course, have to find out how possibly we might be able to do that. Yeah? Yeah, what you do is just here you have a long string of data, right? So say you have 10 to the 6 bits. And now you just have to check, basically, two parties. They just have to check, do we have the same string? Right? Of length 10 to the 6. If it's the same, there's no eavesdropper. Right? Pardon?
They obviously don't want to check the whole string.
Of course, they don't check the whole string, but this is now about statistical testing. Right? The important thing is, as we talk about that, if I have 10 to the 6 signals, right? Now the question, whenever I open a certain number of them, right? Then I can do some statements basically with a high confidence they are the same. Right? So which already tells us something about quantum key distribution. There's always something about statistical issues. Right? I can never say for sure there was an eavesdropper. I can always say it was highly unlikely. And the thing is, as you go on these testing procedures over here, then you can basically come exponentially close to say, I'm sure there was no eavesdropper. And to say basically the probability that you do not detect a difference in bits by testing a small sample size of that can be made basically exponentially small. So that means that we know that they can have high confidence that they actually have the same strength. Right? And basically once you have the same strength, then you really say now they're identical, and now again I can say there was no eavesdropper in the line. Yeah? Yeah.
If the conversation period is long enough, there's still possibility for someone to steal a key, isn't it?
Sorry.
If the two communicate for a long period of time,
yeah.
Then there's still possibility for someone to steal a key, isn't it?
Well, there's of course if that is in cryptographic part, people are always worried if they have a key storage at their home, that basically after some time maybe something leaked out, if that is your problem, right? In principle, yes, but I mean this thing over here to get 10 to the 6 keys can be done still basically depending on which distance we talk about, but that can be done in minutes, right? So we are not talking about years or whatever. And the other thing we'll be actually seeing that I can dynamically refresh the key. That is very something that's coming on. So that at the moment only basically the basic idea, and we will see, of course, that we have to do a few more things around that one before it becomes anything which we might call practical. Yeah?
Can this be at all improved if you choose a third basis?
Yeah, there is the so-called six-way protocol, which uses the third mutual unbiased basis over here, which actually makes it a little bit more stable against errors, yeah? Although there are some problems about implementing it because the implementation gets more complicated and it's not clear whether overall you win or not. Probably not. Right? But that's a practical issue, not a fundamental one. Okay, that's the Bennett-Frassard protocol over here. So the first thing, let's point out something about the public channel, because now we assume basically Eve cannot change what is going on the public channel. Right? Now the question is first, why is that so important? Right? So why is it so important? Well, here are Edith and Bob. They sit there and they execute the BB84 protocol, and they have a classical channel which is, they hope they talk to each other. Right? So there, they sit there, and now you really think about it. You are Alice or you are Bob. You sit in a room, right? You have a telephone, and you have an optical fiber, right? And you follow the BB84 protocol. And at the end of the day, yeah, and you just sit there and say, "Hi, I got that key, and I tested it. Looks good." Do you trust this thing? Well, the answer has to be no, otherwise I wouldn't ask this way, right? So the question is, why would we not trust that if we do not trust that really this public channel was connected between Alice and Bob? But the reason is just that in this gray area over here, what could have happened, yeah, is just this one. It means Eve just actually sits in the middle and she intercepts both of your channels, the classical channel and the quantum channel. Right? And that means if you look over here, Eve has been doing a BB84 protocol with Alice. Alice has no clue that she established a secret key, but not with Bob, but with Eve. Right? It's possible. If you sit in your room, you have no clue with whom you do your secret key. Right? With whoever is on the public channel, apparently. Right? And Eve can as well impersonate Alice to Bob, make here a secret key between Eve and Bob. Right? So for you, it looks fine. You did the BB84 protocol. You didn't find errors. Right? So you happily sent your secret M, encoded in the one-time pad with that key, send it over the channel. What happens is, of course, that Eve can just decode your secret, read it, and encode it again with the key that he shares with Bob, and sends a message on to Bob, or a different one, whatever. Yeah? You see over here that indeed, in that setup, Alice and Bob communicate, they get the messages that they want to get, right? But Eve can read everything. Right? And that is just, the problem is over here, that Eve can block the classical channel, which I used here like radio waves over here, and the quantum channel with something like here, the optical fiber. Right? The important thing is that we really need to make sure who we talk to. And that is something which is something only about the classical channel. It's sufficient to make sure that this classical channel between Alice and Bob, that here I'm sure who is it that I'm talking to. Right? The thing is, of course, again, a problem. Right? So now, so far, basically, we moved from secret communication, said, oh, we just need to do key distribution. Now we have key distribution, and we say, well, there's a little snag to it, and means we need an authenticated channel. But you see, actually, the difficulties are going down. We ask for less and less and less of the problem that we have to solve. Secret communication is difficult. Now we reduce it to only distribute random keys. Well, in order to distribute random keys, you have the BB84 protocol. The only thing that we need to do is basically to make sure Alice and Bob talk to each other, right? On a classical channel, right? And Eve can listen to what they're talking to, right? And that is the authentication problem. You have a propagation.
Can't Alice just ping Bob and ping if it takes too long to come back?
Oh, but that is something Eve could simulate. Because Eve knows what is the time that Alice would expect the thing to come back. So this is known as the man in the middle attack. In principle, there's nothing you can do against that one in that form, as it's written here, if they don't have additional resources. The thing is that you can do something about it, and here the transparency is missing, so I have to... the thing is that we really need to do is just to authenticate our channel. And the thing is, as I said, we are only in the classical domain, right? We have nothing, we don't want to protect the information about someone else listening it. We only want to make sure that I have been talking to the same person. Right? So what do we do for that one? Right? Well, as we follow the BB84 protocol, then on the classical channels, you just exchange lots of communications. You talk about what is the basis, you start to talk about you compare your signals or part of your signals to find that there's an error, whatever. So that's all the stuff that is going over the public channel, right? About the classical public channel, right? So what you get actually over here is that you have a kind of big set of messages that were sent over the channel, and basically both parties, Alice and Bob, have just a transcript of all the stuff that has been said on the channel. Right? And now the thing is, they want to make sure that actually they know that this communication is indeed took place between them. So what we need to make sure is that this thing over here is the same as that one over here. In that scenario here, if you do that one, if you do basically two separate BB84 protocols between Alice and Eve, and between Eve and Bob, then actually they will have different transcripts necessarily. Right? Because all these kind of basis transformation or so on, basis choices are different in that cases. Right? You would better get this, if you have Eve over sitting, Eve over here, then you have the transcript M1, M1 between Alice and Bob, and you have a transcript M2, M2 between Eve and Bob. Right? So if you now try to make sure that Alice and Bob have the same transcript, you fail. Right? The question is, of course, how to do that. Right? The good thing is, people have solutions for that. There are provable information theoretic secure ways about how to make sure that Alice and Bob have the same transcript. That is called message authentication. And it, what it uses is just that Alice and Bob agree beforehand publicly, so Eve knows about that, a set, certain set of functions. They are called hash functions. And it's the set H. Right? And once they have agreed on that set, what they do is after they have done all that communication, right, they somehow pick at random one of those elements over here. So they pick one of those at random, and I come back to that point, right? And then they just calculate H of M Alice, and they calculate H of M Bob. That is called a tag, TA TB, and then they just send it over a channel, swap and compare those tags. If they are the same, then they accept the thing and saying we have the same record. It's similar to checking for the errors. Do we have errors or not? We can use it as well with the so-called hash functions efficiency to look for that one. There's one point we have to be careful about, yeah? And this is one step further about we have been only so far reducing the problem. There's one problem left, and that is how can we pick at random an age of this one to make sure that Eve does not influence the choice. And that we can do if we make this one an initial secret key. Right? That means if we can do key distribution now, if I share, Alice and Bob share an initial secret key, which they use to authenticate the channel in that protocol over here, to make sure that they've been talking to each other, then we can authenticate the channel. We can do quantum key distribution, we get a key, we can use it in the one-time patch, we can do secret communication. Right? Yeah? 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 Yeah. The easiest thing is that this thing over here should be private. This pick over here is something they, basically that's why I say it's like initial secret. Alice and Bob know which hash function they will be using. Eve knows only the family of hash functions that we talk about. But Eve does not know which element to use. And therefore, if you go into that picture over here where I said here M1, M1, M2, M2, right? So basically, if now Bob sends a hash over here, then still an eavesdropper does not know which one, what is the hash function actually to use, and cannot send that one over here. Right? So the thing is really the thing is that you do not know which hash function to use. Right? So that's that is a very important part of it. Right? And as you do that one over here, now you can actually make a secret key, but you see there's a problem. Or better to say, it's not really a problem, but it's now a change of statement what quantum key distribution is doing. You need an initial secret key to do quantum key distribution. Right? The important thing is about how much initial secret key do you need. And that is just double logarithmic in the size of the total message that is exchanged over here. Right? That means I need only a small amount of secret key so that I can do quantum key distribution. At the end of quantum key distribution, I have a large amount of secret key. So quantum key distribution is not creating a secret key out of nothing. Right? What it can do is basically do a secret key growing. You start with a small initial secret key, and you end up with a large one. Right? So that is a very important thing. Right? You can as well, this authentication method, you might as well, instead of using that one, you might use different ways of authentication. You can you can maybe use even some kind of computational secure ways of authentication, something which is only based on the complexity of some calculations. Why so? Well, this authentication over here that I'm doing, right? That is basically important that I do that before I accept a secret key to use for my message. Right? At that point, you really want to be sure this is the secret key I share with Bob. Right? And for that one, you need authentication. If you find a scheme which can be broken by an eavesdropper after 1 hour, after using it for authentication, you don't worry. Right? Because I do now my authentication. I now know now this message I exchanged between Alice and Bob. And if in 1 hour Eve has a way to fake my tag over here or something like that, I don't care. Right? Because it's too late for Eve. Eve has to be able to break my authentication scheme the moment I'm using it. Right? That's different from secret communication. If you do secret communication and use a computationally secure scheme, which means which is secure only against because it's hard to break and takes too long to break it in the interest lifespan of our secret, then of course if someone can break it after 1 hour, your secret is leaked out, right? And you're worried about that one. For the authentication part over here, if you can and someone else can break it after 1 hour, you don't care. The authentication has been done, you accepted your key, and that key is not compromised if later on the authentication scheme is compromised. That's the nice thing about it, right? And so that gives actually as well a little bit more of a handle, maybe how we can use quantum key distribution in practice, right? Because otherwise, of course, I have always the problem how to kickstart quantum key distribution, right? And the thing is, of course, for this initial secret key that I might be using, for that one, I might use a courier or something else. Right? I really have to make sure that I trust this first initial secret key distribution. Right? But after that, I have QKD, and it produces basically continuously forever secret key more. Right? So basically, once I establish my link, point-to-point link, in quantum key distribution by having an initial key for authentication of the public channel, that device is set up and produce more and more secret key all the time. Something you cannot do in classical cryptography. You can prove you cannot do it. If you have give basically in a classical world, give Alice and Bob some initial secret key and give them arbitrary power of communication between them, there's no way that you make more secret key out of it. It simply does not work. Okay, so that's the very important thing about, and I think really to keep that in mind, that is basically the clarification what quantum key distribution is really doing for us. Right? Because quite often people forget about this authentication of the classical channel. That is something that is important to do. Right? And so therefore basically the statement of what quantum key distribution is doing, we have to be careful about what it does for us in practice. Okay, now here comes another thing. Of course, you have heard about quantum key distribution. There are many different schemes around. Right? You hear as well quite a lot of entanglement being used in quantum key distribution. There are two aspects to that. First, whenever we talk about security proofs of quantum key distribution, quite often it's useful to think in entanglement. The question is, of course, if I talk about the BIP84 protocol, there is no entanglement in there. Right? I only send non-orthogonal signal states and I measure them. So that's what we call them prepare and measure schemes. Right? However, as we look at that one, if I have my source over there preparing those signal states, then no one can stop me from thinking about that source in a different way. And I can think about a source that is equal probability send out all those four states over here. No one can stop me from thinking about that I say in my source, I prepare a maximally entangled state, and I prepare and measure one half of it either in the horizontal vertical or in the 45 degree basis. If you do that one, depending on which measurement you do and what measurement outcome you get, you effectively prepare outcoming over here exactly those signal states with the right probability. So that is just a kind of way of, as a theoretician, how to think about your source. Right? Say, but internally that source, I think about it like I prepare an entangled state, I make a measurement on one half of the entangled state, and that tells me basically then, conditioned on that measurement, I prepare exactly the signal state from my protocol with the right probability. Right? And my measurement results tells me which state I prepared. So that is basically what we call the source replacement picture, and that is basically how we introduce entanglement from a theoretical point of view, but not from an experimental point of view. Right? We can go a step further, and the step further is now to say, instead of having the source set up in my source of entanglement, I can actually shift this source out here. Right? And then do here my measurements in the two bases, I do there my measurements in the two bases. Right? And this thing over here still creates a maximally entangled state. If you do that one, you have to be aware that, of course, you change the picture a little bit. Because now you have to ask the question, where does my security come from? Right? Because in the top part, we have been talking security comes from the point of view that whenever Eve interacts with the signals, she will, and learns something about the signals, she will disturb the signal. In that setup over here, what do we mean about signal? Here's the source that sends something here and there. What? What happens? Well, what happens is just that we have to change, indeed we can change basically the formulation of the security. And that thing is basically, here we have our top thing. Someone in the middle sends out a particle to Alice and one particle to Bob. The thing is we don't trust them that it's really a maximally entangled state. What? Alice and Bob just get each a qubit and make a measurement on that. Right? Okay, and now let's just assume what happens if Eve actually does not send a maximally entangled state, right, and distributes it to Alice and Bob. Then it's just some state, psi ABE, right, that she has, basically, which is a pure state, which looks on the particles A and B just like a mixed state at O AB, sent to Alice and Bob, and they do their measurements. However, these measurements that we do over here, which are just measurements in two bases over there, there you can actually see that in the ideal case, they should be perfectly anti-correlated. Right? That is basically what you would expect to see from maximally entangled states. They should be perfectly anti-correlated. And whenever you send something in, which is not the purification of the maximally entangled state over here, if we prepare something different, then these anticorrelations are getting disturbed. So instead of saying, oh, whenever Eve learns something about a signal, she introduces errors, instead we replace that one by saying, whenever Eve does not prepare a maximally entangled state in that source, the correlations will be disturbed. The good thing is that, indeed, once we look at what Eve might be possibly preparing over here, and we look at our measurement data, and we see that we have perfect anticorrelations in all of the two basis choices, whenever Alice and Bob use the same basis choice, then you can prove that this state that Eve prepared is the maximally entangled state tensor something that Eve has. Right? That is very important, because when you have a state of that form, and you are, then you can ask, okay, from that state, what can possibly Eve learn about measurement results that Alice or Bob has? The answer is nothing. Why? Because of the tensor product structure over here. Right? Any measurement I do over here has nothing to do with whatever, but they're statistically uncorrelated with any kind of measurements Alice and Bob do, or measurement results that Alice or Bob do. Right? So that is basically the way how we get actually security in schemes that use entanglement as a real physical entanglement in the source. Right? And I mean, for example, in Waterloo, we have one experiment sitting there. We have the source and sitting on top of one building. Then Els and Bob both do their measurements in the two bases over there. We don't have to trust that source in the middle. By proving that we have anticorrelations in the two bases, we can prove that the source is well behaving and that Eve does not learn anything about our measurement results. And you can basically otherwise follow just the BIB84 protocol with your data and get a secret key out of that. Right? Okay, that's the basics of quantum key distribution. Right? Now we know everything about quantum key distribution, and now it's time to get worried again. Right? It's a great scheme. The BIB84 protocol is really, really great. There's a problem with it. Right? The protocol that we have so far just tells us that you just check for errors, and if there are errors, you say, oh, there was an Eastop problem, and forget about it. Well, we do an experiment, you can be sure there are errors. Right? I mean, there's no way that you have an experiment, we have perfect anticorrelation, or here always perfect correlation. You have always noise in the system. So what we have to do is to make sure that we can make this protocol now stable, that even if I have noise in my implementation, I still can get a secret key out of it. If not, the whole protocol would be useless. Right? The important thing is we have to be able to make it stable, that even if some fraction of my data have errors in there. If I observe, and basically when I compare my data, then see, oh, I have an error rate of 5% or whatever in my data, then I still can make a secret key out of it. That is something that we have to do. Right? And fortunately, it can be done. Right? Whenever Alice and Bob compare the data and they find errors, then you'll see, of course, the first thing that they have to do is they have to do error correction, classical error correction. Because they want to use their string as a key in a one-time pad. And if there are errors, the errors would automatically transfer onto the message. So you have to do classical error correction. There's a second part of it. In quantum key distribution, once we see errors, we have to basically to make the worst-case scenario. Go into the worst-case scenario, and that is just these errors are caused by Eve interacting with our signals. Right? So that's really the worst case scenario that we have to do. And now we have to find out, what does it mean? How much does Eve actually learn from that one? And for that one, just go in a very simple thing what Eve could possibly be doing. The simple thing that Eve could possibly be doing in attacking the BIB84 protocol. And that is the so-called intercept-resend attack. The intercept-resend attack just says, okay, let's assume that Eve has the same devices as Bob. That means basically Eve gets a signal from Alice, does a measurement, and gets a measurement result, and then just she prepares a new single photon in the same polarization as her measurement result actually indicated and sends it over to Bob. Right? So that is Eve's strategy. Now let's find out what happens if Eve is doing that thing. Right? The thing is basically here we can concentrate on the situation where Alice and Bob use the same basis, but Eve does not know which one it is. So for the moment, just let's stick over here to the Alice and Bob use the 45 degree basis. Right? Eve does not know that they're using the 45 degree basis, so Eve has to guess one or the other basis. In case that Eve actually chooses as well, by chance, the same 45 degree basis, then we see, of course, that basically Alice and Bob don't see anything from the presence of Eve. If Alice sends that signal, Eve gets that measurement outcome, the same measurement outcome. She resends that signal to Bob, and Bob gets it over here. Perfect correlation between Alice and Bob. Yeah, the same, of course, if you would go to the other 45 degree signal. Right? In that case, Eve is basically can hide in the data. But of course, since Eve does not know which basis Alice and Bob will be using, right? Because they are random choices, what happens if Eve actually gets it wrong? So here she gets just the horizontal vertical basis. Okay, good. Here Eve gets one of the signals from Alice, and because her measurement device does not fit the basis of the signal, you get just a random outcome, one or that. Okay? Now you resend that thing over here, and then of course this basis does not fit to Bob's device. Again, the outcome is random, this one or that one. So that are basically the basic events that can happen, right? And then of course the same for all the other three signals, right? But already here we see basically, once you look at now the correlation between Alice and Bob in these events, then you see basically in 3/4 of the cases you have the right correlations, but in this instance and in that instance over here, you get actually an error, and that is just 25%. And indeed, this attack introduces an error rate of 25%. Right? If you do it on every single qubit. On the other hand, look at that one and just find out how much does actually Eve learn of that. So basically later on, Alice and Bob talk to each other, and then actually Eve knows sometimes, oh, actually Alice and Bob measured in the same basis as I did. Right? And in that case, Eve knows completely what was the signal. She knows for sure what the signal was sent by Alice. While in that case over here, when she measured on the wrong basis, then she doesn't have any clue, right? And she doesn't know anything. Now these scenarios, this box or that box, each appear with probability 1/2. So what we actually have over here is that if I put in here the error rate, and here the fraction of signals known to Eve, I have now one point where I say 25% error rate, and I know half of the bits. That is all that Eve knows. And that, of course, would be a lot, right? If Eve knows half of our secret key, that is certainly more than we want to tolerate. The important thing is we have to find a way actually to make sure that Eve knows nearly nothing about the final key. Well, now experimental values typically hover around here something 3%, 4%, 5%, right? In that case, of course, we can just think maybe Eve did not attack all of those signals, but only a certain fraction of them. And of course, as we reduce that fraction, we just glide down here on a linear scale up to the 0, 0 point, where Eve introduces no errors, but as well doesn't know anything, right? Because she doesn't attack any signals. But if I have here 5% error rate in my experiment, it still would say that by this attack, Eve would know 10% of the signals, and that's not acceptable. Right? We have to do something about that one. Right? And the method to do that is just called privacy amplification. And I don't want really to go too much into the detail of that. It's just to tell you somehow, to make plausible to you, that there is something we can do about data to cut out Eve's correlation. We have now, Alice and Bob have correlation, they see something like 5% error rate. But we say 5% error rate means still Eve might know 10% of my signals. So Eve is correlated with our key. The question is basically how to kick Eve out. Right? For that one, just let's go to a very simple model about what Eve might be knowing something about our key. Right? Assume that Eve knows for each individual bit, this basically has some bias that she knows about which one it might be. So her guessing probability for each bit might be just 1/2 times 1 plus epsilon. If epsilon is 0, basically Eve doesn't know anything. If epsilon is non-zero, Eve has basically a little kind of clue what it might be. Right? That's just one way to simulate or to model an eavesdropper knowledge, eavesdropper correlation with our key. Right? Okay. Now, that is basically, that's the guessing probability for each of those bits. And now the thing is, let's assume that we have our string over here with all our signals, and all of those bits, Eve has a clue what might the signal might be. Well, if I now start to group those things into groups, say of group 3 over here, right, and then I just take the parity of each group and make that one my new key, then let's see how much does Eve now know. Right? Here on each of those bits up there, that's Eve's probability to guess correctly. Once I make groups and take parities of those groups, then now the probability for Eve to guess correctly this parity bit goes like 1/2 times 1 plus epsilon to the power of n, where n is the block size. You see that by choosing these block sizes bigger and bigger, I can make this epsilon to the power of n arbitrarily small. That means I can come to the situation where Eve doesn't know anything or negligible amount of information about my key. Right? So that is the idea of privacy implication. Right? The thing is, this operation over here, I can as well just write it as a matrix representation. Right? So here's my key, and here's the matrix, which is just nothing else, and here are basically the block parities. If you look now at this matrix, it has here these entries, which makes sure that basically those things, this here is the parity of the first three, that one is the parity of the next three, and so on. That's just a way of writing a matrix. The thing is, of course, you see here, it's a kind of waste. Right? To make this part really small over here, I need bigger and bigger block sizes. But if I choose that one to be n equal to 100, it means the key length that I get shrinks by a factor 100. Right? The good news is I can do better than that. Just use some matrix over here, which even I can choose at random. The only thing is about this matrix over here is the question basically how many differences between any lines exist over here. You see, here the difference between that line and that line, the Hamming distance between them, is 6. Right? And basically now I can make matrices over here that have as well the same kind of Hamming distance, 6, but have many, many more rows. And the number of rows is actually the number of new secret key I get out there after I kicked out Eve's information. Right? For that trick here to work, the only thing is really I need to know the Hamming weight between these rows in that matrix. And there are basically ways, if it basically choose a random matrix, then it tells us the random matrix and I want to get the right Hamming weight over here, then this dimension over here just has to scale with the entropy of this Hamming weight. That's the only thing I need to do. And then I get the same Hamming weight as this trivial example, but with more rows. That means I get more key out of it. And it actually turns out that actually that means I don't have to get my key here by a factor 1 over 100 smaller, but just by some fraction, 50% or so on, and get still the same effect as with that Hamming weight over here. That is basically what privacy implication does for us. It's a purely classical technique at that point. Right? It has been invented, actually, indeed, in context of some classical information theoretically secure schemes. Right? But we have to be careful, of course. This classical techniques is something, if really all my data, all my knowledge by an eavesdropper would be simulated classically. But we know we are dealing in quantum mechanics. Right? So Eve's knowledge in general will be actually modeled by a density matrix that Eve has. So these schemes over here are very useful for our guidance about what is going on. But we have to be careful that it's not directly a security proof of quantum key distribution going through these schemes. But however, we are physicists and you learned in this week a lot of quantum error correction. Right? And so therefore the first important thing is basically to say now, as a quantum information guy, how would you now think about that we can make the thing stable, you know, against noise, right? And the question is, of course, well, at the end of the day, you have a noisy channel, because Eve interacting with the signals is a noisy channel, and now you have to do something to get your signals through that noisy channel so that they are not really disturbed in the end of the day. So what you can do, of course, is just you take your signal, right, and you just encode it into qubits. Once you encode it in qubits, then you can send each individual through that noisy channel, which is controlled by an eavesdropper. Eve tries to learn something, adds noise to it. But once you come out over here, you know, you have your noisy version of your input, you just decode it again, and there you go. Right? So we know how I can turn, even if I have a noisy channel, I know how I can create effectively a perfect channel via quantum error correction codes. And now the thing is, of course, that I just do here the basis choice and the data which tells me which state I want to prepare and bring to the other side. And once I get that one signal over here, of course, I send it onto my detector. Right? So even if I have channel and devices that have only some errors in them, then I know, of course, in principle, with quantum error correction codes, I can still make quantum key distribution. Right? Yeah? No. And the way that you can see it really is, in the end of the day, you can take all of that stuff over here. That is a black box. It's a new channel. Right? You can say, here is the state that I want to do, and now my channel starts by encoding, sending, and decoding, and then spitting it out again. Oh, but that's the part in the channel. The thing is really, as long as I put that state in there, it goes through whatever procedure and it appears on the other side unchanged. Then I know no eavesdropper that is controlling all these operations can learn something from it. Right? Because the structure is in the channel. But I don't, for the security, I don't really think about the structure of it. I just see something that I can put non-orthogonal signal states into some procedure, and Bob, on the other hand, gets it unchanged out. That's the only thing I care about when I talk about security. And then I know that no one, even having access to the encoding and decoding operations, can learn something about my signal states. That's the beautiful thing. Right? There's, of course, once we think about it, then we know, okay, well, if I can do all these quantum error correction codes, now I can do quantum key distribution again. But of course, you know, if you don't want to do quantum error correction codes, then you have to be able to do quantum logic operations. Yeah, you have to entangle your system, you have to manipulate them, you have to do gates and all of that. The problem is, of course, that we don't really have the ability yet to do those things. But there's a good thing. Here, we have classical data, which tells us which state prepare, go through that one, and then here we again do classical data. We don't really want to see these quantum states over here perfectly. We just want to have the signature of perfect correlations over here between the two sides. Right? Basically, we don't use really the quantum states. We just use a measurement. And now the thing is, if once we go for a quantum error correction code, which has a nice structure like the CSS codes, then basically what you can do is that these classical operations over here commute with all those things in a specific way. That is where a lot of footnotes come and all the stuff that I leave out. The important thing is, in the end of the day, is that I can actually think about this whole procedure like preparing some states, sending through the channel, detecting them, which is actually exactly what the BIP84 protocol is doing, and then get on my data and do classical error correction and classical privacy verification just as I described it before. And the idea is basically really that these measurements commute with the encoding over here. And that means here I do actually my sending and my detection, but the encoding and decoding operation now become purely classical procedures on my data. And they turn into classical error correction and classical privacy verification. This one is just the bit error correction of the CSS codes. This one becomes the phase error correction. It's related to the phase error correction. Right? So that's way about proving security of quantum key distribution. That's the Shor-Preskill security proof. Right? It uses this idea that I know I can do quantum error correction with CSS codes, and then go through procedures to show how you can, instead of doing these quantum operations, how you can map it into that simple thing about sending signals, detecting them, having noise and all of that, and then basically doing classical error correction, classical privacy verification on top of that. Right? So the important thing is that, of course, here, that is something that we accept that this is possible. Right? And from a structure over here, we can as well then convince ourselves that maybe something like that is possible as well. And that indeed tells us in the end of the day how much privacy amplification we have to do. That means how much we have to shrink our key in privacy amplification to make it really secure. These statements come from the quantum error correction codes in the end of the day. Because that's something you know. The moment you do encoding, right, you have your secret, which is the stuff that you can transport through that, and you have basically encoded in a larger space. And that means basically once I go into the classical procedure, I have first lots of classical data with some errors in there, and then I do error correction privacy amplification, and then I end up, this is really the result of my final secret key, as if I had done that one and done my BIP84 protocol on this level. Right? So it's basically, it tells us always, once I do these things over here, only a small fraction or a smaller fraction of that will really end up as a secret key in my hand afterwards. Right? And this is clear from that kind of embedding in quantum error correction code pictures. Okay, the formula actually that comes from that is just something about that we learn from the CSS codes, basically how big do I have to make the code that I can cope with a certain number of bit errors and a certain number of face errors. And actually the key rate that comes out of that basically is just like that. It basically says basically I have to shorten my key. It's not the number of physical signals that I send from Alice to Bob. First, there's a factor 1/2 because Alice and Bob have to do the sifting, basically end up in the same measurement basis, both of them. Right? And then basically there's a contribution of the bit error correction, with the phase error correction, which is the privacy amplification. And then there's something, basically something which comes through the normal error correction on the bit errors. Right? And so that total thing over here is now our secret key rate. And basically, that is just now something which actually gives us a positive key rate up to 11%. Right? So up to 11%, this security proof tells us, yes, we do quantum key distribution. And that is really unconditional security in the sense that this thing, even if I have 5% error rate, I go through that procedure, Eve basically knows negligible amount, and that means it can make it exponentially small, this amount that Eve might know about that key. Right? Yeah? No, that is against whatever Eve is doing, because the quantum error correction codes protect you against whatever is happening. Right? So basically, if you go through that picture over here, yep, over here, there's no constraints about what is happening over here. Right? So here is nothing about intercept, resend, or whatsoever. That says whatever is happening in these channels, even if they're correlated errors and so on, as long as your quantum error correction code works, right, then you are safe.
Even though Eve has like quantum memory.
Eve has quantum memory, Eve has whatever. Right? The thing is really, as long as your quantum error correction works, and in this protocol you check that your quantum error correction worked. Right? Because you see now something about correlation, there's something observable for you that it says that works. Then you're fine. So that is really against the most general thing that Eve can be doing. Right? Then you get this kind of key. Actually, the thing is basically there are little things like this factor 1/2 is not really important. Right? The thing is this factor 1/2, it only comes because we choose each of the bases with equal a priori probability. You can refine your calculation and just make it dominantly using one basis, only with a small probability the other one. And then you see basically this factor here can be sent to 1. Right? So that is not really important. Right? So these factors. The other thing is, of course, even you can find more refined ways in the classical part of your protocol, which sends this one up to, I think for the BIP84 protocol at the moment, we are up to 20% of errors that we can tolerate. But then you have to do more refined protocols running through that. Okay. The thing is, of course, in the end of the day, once we talk about security, we have to be careful about what the security definition is in the whole game, right? Because what we want to say, Eve does not know something about the key. Of course, we already said that in the end of the day, it has to look at something like Eve knows only a negligible part about my secret key. How do we formulate it, given the situation that Eve holds a quantum state, right? Because if she interacts with signal, we should not force Eve to measure out the system that interacted with our signals. She might keep it as a quantum part. So the security definition necessarily has to be a quantum part. And so basically what we can do is just, the thing is that basically the identity matrix shared by Alice, Bob and Eve, and here I use this kind of source replacement picture, the theoretician view about introducing by force entanglement into the picture even if there isn't some, that this density matrix differs from one where we have here the measurement results of Alice and Bob, basically represented by orthogonal state vectors, and then Eve being basically tensored off from that one. Eve basically is not correlated with those things. That basically the actual situation in our experiment, from the ideal situation where Eve is absolutely not correlated to Alice and Bob's measurement result, then this one has in some norm, here the trace norm, has to be smaller than epsilon. That is the kind of really security definition that we are using. And it becomes really important to use these kind of quantum-based security definitions, because once we start to do our authentication in the way that we say, hey, I use initial secret key to authenticate my channel, then I have a large new secret key. If you want to next time QKD, what you want to do from this large secret key, use lots of that for your communication, but keep some for to authenticate the next round. Right? So that's our question, that say, ah, but next time you did it, you know, you were only secret up to some epsilon. How can you use it for authentication like it would be a perfect secret key? That's a question of composability. Right? Can I use what comes out of quantum key distribution in authentication or whatever other protocols like it were a perfect secret key, and how do the security parameters scale? All that goes in there, and we use this kind of security definition. The important thing is basically what we can do is the kind of generalization of the key rate. And that basically makes it easier now to look at different kind of schemes. Instead of overthinking about the quantum error correction codes, Renner came up with something before that, David Aquinter, in some restricted scenario, which gives us a kind of key formula which just says, well, we have here just the Shannon information between Alice and Bob, classical Shannon information between Alice and Bob. And here we have the Rolever quantity, just saying what are the conditional states Eve holds given that Alice has certain measurement outcomes or send a certain signal state. That formula over here, if you evaluate it for the BB84 protocol, just reproduces the formula that I showed to you before. But it's based only on the conditional state of an eavesdropper, yeah, and the probability that that Alice sends certain signal states over here. And then you can just calculate that thing. And basically the thing is, these expressions over here, they have basically been optimized just over all possible density matrices A, B, E that Eve has, that are compatible with your observations. That means here some optimization involved, which just says in your experiment you observe certain number of errors for these and these and these signals, right? So that means the total density matrix shared between Alice and Bob and Eve must have certain constraints. That is actually how quantum mechanics works, right? In the source replacement, Alice and Bob have quantum states before they measure, and Eve has a purification of it. Quantum mechanics tells us that as we know what are the measurements that Alice and Bob are doing on their signals, there are some constraints how Eve might be possibly, the purification might look like. That is the power of quantum mechanics and quantum key distribution. From our observations, we can put bounds and limits and forms how a third party can be correlated with our quantum systems. Right? And then this thing over here is just a measure of these correlations. And it actually gives us something about how much secret key we can get out of that. Okay. Good. So far for that, the important thing is basically that I wanted to bring across over here is that we can make quantum key distribution stable against errors. Right? So we don't have to say, okay, when now we see an error, throw it away, because that would be impractical. We can make it stable. Yeah. Well, here we assume that we basically have the reference frame that in the sense that we know what the polarizations are. the kind of alignment. The thing is, if we are wrong in the reference frame, then it only just looks like an increased number of errors. Right? Well, there are some schemes that deal with the fact that some of the optical channels that we are doing, like polarization, is affected by optical fibers as doing rotation. But these rotations just go slow in time. They're only drifting slow in time. So you can basically, in a way, error correct against that one by using kind of like a free qubit code, which can extract actually the measurement result independent on what rotation you put on that. But that's leading a little bit more to the side. And it's probably not the biggest problem that we are fighting quantum key distribution, and therefore not that practical yet. Because as we will see, the moment you start to implement quantum key distribution, we have been focusing now here on the error rate, right? But believe me, in all optical implementation that we're doing, the error rate is the least of our worries. That means, of course, there must be some other worry. And the other worry is we don't worry about the polarization, turning, shifting. The biggest thing is actually loss. What happens if we lose signal, right? Because that might be controlled by an eavesdropper. Eavesdropper might control which signals we should get, which we should not get, and that is our biggest problem in the whole game. Right? And we will see as well why. Okay, here is schematically how a practical quantum key distribution scheme actually looks like. Right? You take just a kind of laser. You just have here intensity modulator, or is something to bring the intensity down. Then you do some encoding of your pulses. Instead of polarization, you might go into a phase encoding, which is equivalent to polarization, only that the kind of two polarization modes, basically how to think about phase encoding. Polarization means you have two modes sitting there, one with horizontal, one with the vertical polarization. And the others, basically single photons in the 45 degree, these are just superpositions. Well, that's polarization. Phase encoding just means these two modes, instead of having them nicely sitting on top of each other, which is just with a different polarization degree of freedom, just pull them apart in time, put them in the same polarization mode, and have them sitting there. And then you have the photon here, or a photon there, or a superposition of photon here and there. It's completely equivalent to polarization. But it's actually more stable for optical fiber implementation. So that's actually what it's doing over here. This split pulse basically is coming in. If it's a single photon, it would be split in an equal superposition of going here or there. One component is delayed. The other one gets a relative phase to each other, which compares to imprinting a polarization on the single photon on that. Then the total thing goes through an optical fiber. On the other hand, over here, what you do is just basically split those pulses over here and make some interference between the two parts, which becomes, again, equivalent to polarization. Right. Okay, now, there are many things over here that don't look like our BB84 protocol. The first part, over here, we don't have single photons. These laser pulses give us our typical Poissonian photon number distribution. Right? They're not single photons. What is the issue over here? If you have the source emits sometimes as well multiple photons. And multiple photon is now great for Eve. She can take one photon out and send the other one to Bob. Bob will still receive the other photon, we get a detector click, but Eve has a perfect copy about what's going on. That's dangerous. Right? As I will show to you, we can still deal with that one. Yeah, we can compensate for that one. But then the other thing is that we have channels over here, fiber optics of free space, and here the biggest effect in channels is basically not that they introduce errors in the degree of freedom that we use for the signals, but they introduce loss. Right? So that's really the biggest thing, and the loss typically, as we go to further distance, is something like 30 or 40 dB. That means the probability for a single photon to arrive on the other side is only 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4. They are typical numbers. Yeah? So this is very low. Right? Then we have detection devices on the other side. And there we use photon counters. Photon counters typically cannot discriminate whether they get 1, 2, 3, 4 photons. They only can discriminate no photon or at least one photon. Right? And so that is something that we have to deal with. Right? There's various schemes that work with other kinds of homodyne detection schemes or something like that. Right? The performance limitation is as well in those schemes. We have a performance limitation. What happens actually if we use this kind of scheme for the BB84 protocol? How much secret key can we get out of it? Right? And the thing is, of course, for that one is that to generate secret key, the first requirement at all is that we get a click over here. Right? For that one, a single photon has to make it from here to there. Right? That's the transmittivity, that has a 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4 probability we have been talking about. Right? So the key rate actually goes with increasing distance, it goes down, and fiber optics actually goes exponentially down in distance. Right? What the key rate can look like. Yeah? You have as well problems that you have here, your detectors, and they try to click. The question is now, can I just increase the clock rate of my detector, of my whole setup, go to gigahertz detection or more, right? Make it faster and faster to compensate this kind of loss problem over here. And then the problem is at some point your detectors can't see that many clicks really, and you really run into technical difficulties in that, because then always one detector goes click, he's dead for some time. Right? And that limits the number of counts you can see in a detector. Right? So there are all kind of problems coming into that one. Right? And then the other thing is, of course, as your signal goes down, there will be some noise. Right? And you know, one of the effects of detectors especially that they have dark cones. If I go over a long distance with my signal, and the probability to see really a photon over there is only 10 to the minus 4, if my dark cone probability basically goes up, at some point I have more dark cones of my detectors clicking than I have clicks from real signal. That means my effective error rate is creeping up the further and further I go into distance. That leads at some point to a cutoff because my error rate gets too big and I must assume that Eve knows too much about my signal. Right? Okay, good. Another thing is, in all of that, we want to make security. Right? The problem in the first part, we have been just talking about sending qubits, we are preparing qubits, sending them over a qubit channel, and making qubit measurements. What I wanted to show you with the previous diagram is that, look, that's not what's happening in experiments, because you use laser pulses, fibers that support optical modes, and then you do detection devices that again act on optical modes. There are no qubits in that game. The natural language of optical communication are optical modes, and they are infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. Right? And the question is basically how to deal with all that mess so that we still can do secret communication. Right? And the thing is, by now we know actually how to talk about this kind of nice model over here, right? We have your qubits, qubit channel, qubit detection. How to link it to a laser, these kind of optical mode channels, threshold detectors over here. Right? And there are three points that I want to talk about. The first thing is how to deal with the difference between a laser and a qubit source. And there is a way how we actually can introduce qubits again by force. We can as well talk about these optical mode detectors and can find qubits into that picture again and basically link that one to the qubit channel. And that means we can indeed link all our optical implementation once we know how. We can actually link it and find the qubit part of it that we started before in all of that mess again and be confident again about what we are doing. And we will see, of course, it has some influence about what the rates are and so on. Right? There's a one point addition that I want to say, and that is something, the method which is called the Decoy method, and that is something as well to make sure how can we in optical situations actually test our channel over here better, and that has something to do with the loss in our channels and the action on that, but I come to that. So the important thing really this section is about how to link those things over here, the optical systems, how to link them to all the qubit stuff that we've been talking before. Right? Okay, the first thing is about the source. Right? Here, Alice and Bob are connected, and the important thing of that connection of the quantum channel over here is that what I said is a loss. Yeah, there's large loss in there. And now we go to the situation that actually Alice over here uses not a single photon source in polarization, but just uses faint laser pulses that have a Poissonian photon number distribution. Right? The thing is basically, what we can think that if can be doing, so you can replace that lossy line by a perfect line that transmits all photons perfectly to the other side. And then she can build in a tap over here, which we call the photon number splitting attack, that just says, whenever there's more than one photon in the pulse, Eve takes one out. And once Eve has this one photon, we go through the BIBA84 protocol. At some point, Alice and Bob use a classical authenticated channel to say in which basis she prepared her signals. Now you see, of course, what's happening. So Eve just took that photon out of a pulse, of a multi-photon pulse, stored it, waited until she now knows what basis to be the signal was prepared, and then she measures that photon in that basis. And she knows for sure what is it that Alice actually has been sending there. Right? So that's basically the problem about the multi-photon pulses. The thing is basically that if I look at my source over here, it just has probabilities for different things. For having no photon in there, single photon in there, multi-photon in there. Right? If we talk about weak laser pulses with a mean photon number of 0.1 or something like that, then it's 90% vacuum, 9% single photon, 1% multiphoton. Right? On the other hand, we have a lossy channel. Right? And now we just look at Bob over here. From all time slots, in many of them, Bob doesn't detect anything. In some of them, Bob detects something. Right? And now is the question, in that scenario, what can Eve do? Well, Eve is smart. Eve can do this kind of attack over here. What she does now is, whenever she sees there was no photon, of course, she makes sure that Bob gets no photon and there no detection event happens. Whenever Eve sees there's a multiphoton, she says, hey, I take one off. There's always still one photon left. That photon that is left goes through the perfect channel to Bob and is certainly detected at Bob's place. Right? And then you have single photons, and basically with single photons over here, what Eve can now do is either block it, that means throw it away, or send it to Bob over there to be detected. And all of that basically now, what we have to do is just to compare and find out can we really make secret key. So the first scenario would be basically if the number of detected signals is smaller than the number of multi-photon signals of the source, we cannot make any secret key. We are dead completely. Because Eve could, in principle, for each individual signal that arrived at Bob's place, have a copy in her hand and break the QKD scheme. Right? So our only chance to make secret communication is if the number of detected signals is bigger than the number of multi-photon signals. Because in that case, Eve must have transmitted at least some of the single photons from Alice to Bob. And on those signals now, Eve cannot have complete information. And actually, whenever Eve tries to learn something about these number of these signals over here, she will introduce errors over here. Right? So that is basically the scenario that we have. So we have basically for sure an upper bound that the key rate cannot be bigger than basically the difference between the number of detected signals and the multiphoton signals. We can make secret key at most out of those things. But there we have a chance, right? Because basically from our observation, if we see no errors at all in all of those signals, then we know especially there were no errors in those things over here. And that means Eve does not have complete information. And then we can invoke privacy implication again and say, hey, we know something about how much Eve might know about our key. It's a certain fraction that is the fraction of multiphoton signals, but there's something that Eve does not know, and hopefully privacy implication can, by shortening the key, make basically a key which comes the security from those events over here. Right? Okay, now, the thing is basically now, how do we think that privacy implication can help us here? Right? Because there are some signals which are just multiphoton signals and they lead to Eve. Right? And some of them are just single photon signals, and there we say, oh, there's something about error rate, whatsoever. the important thing is basically here we talk about optical mode, and now basically what we want to do is the source description, bring it back to qubits. Right? Here is the optical mode with the 0, 1, 2, whatever photons in polarization. Right? And we have to basically come now here to the to qubits again. And the thing is really basically here our laser source can be described just as a Poissonian distribution of Fock states. That's what it stands for here with the polarization over here. And what we just say is whenever there's a multiphoton signal, we give up directly and say, ah, sorry, that signal Eve knows. That's what we call tagging. And we give just Eve the classical information about that signal. That's good. Because in our description now, we can now, for the source, go back to qubits, that are the single photons in polarization, and the classical information whether, oh, maybe Eve knows everything. We don't have to deal really with infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces anymore. We just talk about some signals which are qubit signals, and some signals which are classically known to Eve. Yeah, and that are the multi-qubit signals, multi-photon signals, right? And now we just look at these privacy implication things. So we already said that the privacy implication means we have here a corrected key, we have here a privacy implication matrix, and we map it to something smaller. Right? That is how privacy implication works. Yeah, that's basically the method that I introduced over here. Okay, now let's assume that some of those things over here are tagged. That means they are classically known to Eve. Right? So, these reds are once tagged. Right? For the moment, let's pretend we know where they are. Right? Of course, we don't. But for the moment, let's pretend we know what's going on. Well, if you look at this matrix multiplication, what you will be noticing over here is that these tagged qubits just intact with only certain columns of that matrix. Right? And if I now just look at that, then this product over here I can write out actually in two terms. One thing is just the white parts of the key with Z columns, gives this one, plus, and now comes here the red part with that red part, and of course all addition, whatever, is modulo 2, yeah? That's how our calculation runs over here. Okay, now, the tagged ones are the ones that Eve knows completely. That means Eve knows that red vector for sure. Right? Okay, but as long as we know there are some parts over here which are white, and the dimension of this privacy implication matrix is good enough so that that thing over here becomes a secret key, then the total thing is a secret key. Because if Eve has no clue on that, but perfectly knows that, then Eve has no clue on this final key, the sum of the two. Right? So that's the important thing. I can think about tagging, and once I know tagging, I just can talk about that privacy implication matrix, and can just think about there are some parts which Eve knows, some parts which Eve does not know, right? And then the total thing is secret. The important thing is, of course, I don't have a clue which are the tagged ones, which are not the tagged ones. But this thing over here I told you, it's basically a random matrix, right? And it actually, if I just have picked this matrix at random as one method to generating privacy implication matrices, so then everything is just only about the dimension of this matrix, how many rows, how many columns over here, then I don't care whether these are the red ones or the other one red. If you redistribute, the question is only how many reds are there and how many whites. Right? And then the dimension of that thing, we always say, we always end up in that situation. And no matter which are the red and the white, the sum is always the same. And so basically, that thing is a secret thing I can do. Right? So here's the important thing, really, how you see that by using the idea of tagging, that I say I have an imperfection of the source because it emits multiphotons or something like that. I call that tagging. I give it completely to Eve. Then as long as I know there's the upper bound how many of those signals I give to Eve, then even if I don't know which one I'm giving to Eve, I can do privacy amplification and I get a secret key out of it. The thing is basically how does it influence the key rate? Right? Because now the dimension of this matrix has to be such that this white remainder matrix over here does the proper amount of privacy amplification. But the formula that you get here is just basically if you set this R to 2, 1, you get just the old Shor-Preske security proof formula out of there. Right? The only thing basically that now this thing overtails over here, that this error rate has to be rescaled as a general factor in front of it. And that is just using that thing and saying, well, I need to make sure that this white matrix has the right dimensions. What does it mean? It means exactly that. It basically tells us that as we go in the, where is this? Basically it tells us the secret key comes first from here. Oh, maybe I can use, hey. Let's see. Yeah, it works. Isn't that amazing? Right. So basically it tells us first the factor 1/2 was basis choice. I told you that's not important. Then comes first that expression over here that tells us, well, the secret key can come only from that difference between detected multiphotons. That is what we call the ratio R here. That is the kind of worst-case scenario. What is at least the number of single photons contributing to the detected signals? Right? However, from that part, right? So that is just basically that's this difference over here. Great. I still have to do price amplification because I have, if I observe an error rate in that, right? Then the error rates now can come only from here. Right? Eve wouldn't introduce errors here, but only from there. But that is the error rate, number of errors for all detected signals. But I have to do privacy amplification for that, but that means that the error rate in that process of that is higher. Right? Because all of the errors in all those things come only from here. So if I see here 2% error rate, but I see that basically only a small amount really comes from the single photon, then within the single photon they have a much higher error rate. That is the rescaling that is happening over here. Right? So that is the amount of privacy amplification I have to do, right? To decouple Eve from the effect of these errors. And then comes here something which is not preceded by that factor R over here. That is the effect basically of classical error correction. Because if you have a large number of data, some of them tagged, some of them not tagged, they have an overall error rate and ELSENBOFF have to do classical error correction just to make them equal, to fit to each other. That is where this part comes from here. Right? So that is the whole thing, basically what we get just by tagging. Right? And that gives us the formula. And basically you see basically to get that formula we have been all arguments we've been reducing to qubits. Right? That is the stuff that we really have been doing over here. Good. Then next comes that was the source. Now what about the detector? Because even if I would send single photons in optical fibers, so I wouldn't really worry about tagging, right? They come to my detector, but my detector looks at modes. My detectors are typically threshold detectors that click or don't click. So is there any danger with that? And of course there's a danger with that. How do I get this one? Whatever. Now what happens, right? So what happens if I have detectors that can get only click or no click, and I do these kind of measurements over here? The first important thing as we look at optical modes is that we say, okay, if I don't know what comes in there, Eve might be sending many photons in here. Even if Alice sent originally only one photon, maybe Eve finds a strategy where she sends many photons. Right? But if you send many photons in there, what can happen? Either none of the detectors click, or that one clicks, or that one clicks, or both click. Right? Now you look at the BB84 protocol, and you just look there, what do I do if both detectors click? Yeah, BB84 protocol doesn't tell you anything. It says if you get this result or that result, right? That's the only thing that happens. And BB84 protocol even doesn't tell you something if your no detector clicks. But that is usually something that primary exchange security proofs can solve. Well, in that case, if the detector doesn't click, okay, forget about it, yeah, and throw it away. But the thing is basically what happens with these double clicks. Now the thing is, people were tempted at the beginning just to throw them away. Right? If both detectors click, obviously you cannot decide if it was a 0 or 1, so something must have been wrong. Should I throw them away? You should not. Why is that you should not? Basically, if you say, whenever both detectors go click, I just throw them away and continue like ignoring those issues. what we can do, we can look back at this intercept resend attack. Right? We went through that before. So Eve does a measurement and resends one photon and sends it to Bob. Now Eve knows that you throw away double clicks and ignore that issue. So what does Eve do? Well, it's easy. Instead of sending one photon to Bob, Eve sent over 5 million photons, the same polarization as her measurement result, to Bob. Why would she do that? Well, if you go through that, Alice sends that, Eve measures the right basis, sends 5 million photons to Bob, all those 5 million photons will end in one detector. Yeah? And this detector just says click, and we have this 45 degree basis. Right? So nothing happened. Huh? The interesting thing happens here. What happens if Eve actually got the wrong basis? Here comes a single photon from Alice. Eve, say, gets this random outcome from the two, this one, and now sends 5 million copies of that photon into Bob's detector. What will happen? Of course, you get a double click. Right? Because that is basically now the probability for each photon to go one arm and the other is 50%. You have 5 million, whatever, the photons going there. So basically, you always get a double click. Right? So once you do that one and say, oh, here gets a double click, or here you get a double click, always. That means whenever Eve gets the wrong basis wrong, you get a double click. If you now throw those things away, that means you throw away all those things over here, and you keep only these events over there. But that are exactly the events where Eve knows what you sent. Right? So basically, here is really one thing, where now suddenly, if you do this kind of selection, throwing away all double clicks, right, then you know basically you keep only those things that Eve completely knows, and the scheme is completely broken. Right? Without any, basically, then you would say afterwards, oh, error rate was zero, yeah? And we know Eve knows all the signals completely broken. Right? So we have to do something about it. One thing is, of course, in these things, you can just check how many double clicks do you have, right? And then just say, oh, if you have so many double clicks, then maybe so often Eve might have used some more than one photo and so on. And you can do wonderful long papers on that. And I did that long time ago, and I'm getting fed up of that. But there's a much more elegant way of seeing the same thing now. You see, the problem is really that we have here the input in that thing is not a qubit, but it's some bigger object. And together with our choice now, how we deal with these outcomes over here, right, we open a security loophole. So when we want to find a clean way how to connect all those things to qubits, and once we did that one, we don't worry about any of these effects anymore. That is something what we have been doing over here, and basically what we have been doing here is to do something which is a post-processing. Instead of throwing away the double clicks, we just do a 50-50 assignment. Whenever it's a double click, we call it a 0 or a 1 with 50-50 chance. Right? That means now, if Eve does this intercept resend attack, you suddenly get again a kind of 25% error rate for the intercept resend. Right? So basically, Eve pays a penalty for doing the intercept resend, which is just the same as if we had been in the qubit picture. Right? And the logic behind that, at the end of the day, is this device, with that post-processing, we can actually represent it as a thought setup. We don't have to do it, just as a thought setup. These things over here, which we have in our lab and what we're doing in our lab, we can think about it as first having a squashing map, which is just a completely positive map, which exists and looks horrible, but the important thing is only it exists, which takes the input from the modes, which might contain 5 million photons or whatsoever, and outputs only a qubit or a vacuum flag. And on that qubit then, we just do our ideal measurement, only that we now are guaranteed that we have only a qubit in there. The important thing is over here, is that this squashing map exists in such a way that for whatever input state we give over here to that real device in our lab, and then we calculate probabilities to get one of those three events, that is exactly modeled by that thought setup. this sort at setup gives exactly the same probabilities. So it's really a full valid model about how we can think what our device is doing internally. Once we do that, then we can say as well, let's make Eve stronger. That is a thought I set up from what we're doing in our lab. I give Eve the control of that squashing device over here. So basically, I simply draw the line where actually Bob starts and Eve ends. I shift it to the right. The only thing I keep and retain is the promise that it's a qubit. Right? So these methods over here, the fact that I can represent for this type of measurement, I can represent this as a kind of two-step method, allows me now to assume without loss of generality that Eve sends me qubits. Right? Important for this one to work was that I do this specific part of post-processing. That thing does not work if you throw away double clicks, then you cannot find a two-step procedure matching that. Right? So it's important what is the choice, what you're doing with that over here in your post-processing. Right? And once you do that one, you do the two-step thing, now you can just interpret your data by just doing this random sign of double clicks over here, like you always get qubits. And then that means now this formula from before, that now really tells us that is the secret key formula, even if we use only threshold detectors. Because before that, when I talked about the multiphoton thing, I showed you all this formula, but I hadn't talked yet about what happens on the detector side. People tend to forget the detector side. Right? The important thing is now this here gives the argument why I can, in that particular case, forget about the detector side and treat it like qubits over here, if I do this kind of double-click assignment. Right? And that means now we have qubit-qubit channels. Tagging tells us that the source I can think about like a qubit. This kind of squashing model for detectors tells me on the receiver side, I can think about like a get qubit. And that despite the fact that my experiment is everything playing in modes. I can connect the mode experiment directly to the qubit security proofs again. Right? Okay. Now we are running a little bit late. I think actually I might stop here. Yep. I might stop by doing the only thing, maybe give the outlook over here, and that is just to say, how do these things now perform? Because I showed you the formula, but I didn't show what things look like. The important thing is first that if we talk as a function of a distance, and here we talk about something like optical fibers, the transmittivity, the single photon probability to arrive on the other side goes exponentially down. Here, the logarithm of the key rate is just goes linear down because of my logarithmic scale. Right. The thing is, at some point, the dark count of my detector take over, and it kills me down here. Right? I can't really go to infinity. Right? I have as well something that my detectors over here cannot have enough counts in that part because there would be too many counts, but each kind of cycle of my apparatus would give me a count. My detector is not that fast. So that is basically the kind of typical curve that you would get from any QKD scheme. Right? These are now basically kind of curves that we calculated in a kind of projection what we think different QKD protocols can do in the future. And you see that here all the kind of very similar behavior over here. We didn't insert here the saturation at the beginning, but here these are an effect of darkons we get actually down over here. And basically what we have been talking about so far is this weaker impulses with the no decoy state method, and that is basically the formula that I showed to you. Right? This scale over here is in dB. That's the kind of exponent of the loss coefficient, but basically here we translated that one in optical fiber, and there you see basically something 60, 70 kilometers. That's probably what we project we could do in that method. There's some simple additional method, which is called decoy state QKD distribution. And that is really where you test your channel, whether Eve can really always take out one photon from the multiphoton pulses, or maybe you can show that Eve has to pass through more of the single photon signals from your source to your detection. Right? That is something where you can actually show and test your channel, because the physical model of an optical fiber is not that something takes out from the multiphoton always one photon, but it's just a kind of Poisson distribution effect on a beam splitter. And that lets many more of the single photons indeed end up in the detection device, and the Coystead method, just by using intensity variations of the thickness, finds out how many of single photons, but it gives you a better estimate how many of single photons really contribute to your detected thickness. Right? And if you do that thing, then actually then you see basically the performance really improves quite a lot. You see first the slope increases. That is here goes with the square of the transmittivity, that goes linear with the transmittivity, which is the same thing like what if you had a